You're tuned into Madiba's Radio, broadcasting live from Nelson Mandela University.
I have fought against white domination, and I have fought against black domination. I have carried the idea of a democratic and free society, in which all persons live together in harmony and with equal opportunity. It is an idea which I hope to live for and to achieve. But if needs be, it is an idea for which
I am prepared to die. Nelson Mandela University. Change the world. You're tuned into Madiba's Radio, changing the world one voice at a time.
What's good? What's up, everybody? You are currently tuned in to Madiba's Radio, where we connect, inform, and absolutely engage. These are our podcasts, and this right here is the Law Show podcast with myself, Katlego Mofokeng, also known as Girl with the Nice Pants on the Instagram streets. Now, this past week, we have been seeing a whole lot of headlines with names of people either missing or unfortunately who have lost their lives at the hands of people who by right were supposed to trust. Sometimes it's people who are complete strangers, but I would like to believe that if what we call a rainbow nation actually is supposed to be a rainbow nation, we should not be afraid of strangers actually putting their hands on us, on ending our lives and exploiting us in the worst possible way. Now, today we discuss all of the names that we have seen in these headlines, and we also come straight home. We look at a situation and a case that has happened so close to our university, that is actually on another campus, George campus. But before we do anything else, it was very important that we say hello to you, we greet you and let you know what's up, what's popping. It is about to be a very sad episode, but I think it's important that we understand the gravity of what it is that we are facing as women and children in modern day South Africa. We know that crime knows no borders. Around the world, stories of violence, exploitation, and harm echo from communities large and small. But here in South Africa, we find ourselves in a particular kind of crisis. A national emergency of gender-based violence and child exploitation that has turned homes, schools, and streets into battlegrounds. The law is supposed to protect us, but for South Africa's most vulnerable, it's women and children. Does it really? Today on The Law Show, we turn to the courtroom, to the Constitution, and to the lives that have been altered forever. We begin with a six-year-old girl from the West Coast whose name now haunts the headlines, Jocelyn Smith. Now, we know that crime is everywhere, it's not news, but in South Africa, there's a heaviness around the violence we see, especially when it comes to women and children. We grew up hearing that children are the future, but if that is true, then what does the future look like when children disappear and no one seems to notice until it's far too late? This is the story of Jocelyn Smith. She was 6 years old, lived in Saldanha Bay, and in February of 2024, Jocelyn vanished. At first, it looked like another tragic missing child case in South Africa, one of far too many, but it wasn't that simple, not even close. What came out in court later was chilling. Jocelyn's mother, Kelly Smith, wasn't telling the full story. Along with her boyfriend, Jacqueline Apollis, and their friend, Stefano van Rijen, she was accused of something unimaginable, and that is handing over her daughter to a sangoma for 20,000 rand. A six-year-old child trafficked, allegedly for muti, her eyes and skin. No trace of her has been found, no body, no resting place, just a cold, sharp silence. And this is how it ended in court. A packed room, a devastated community, and a judge reading out justice, or at least what we hoped was justice.
Mr. Apollis and Van Rijn and Miss Smith. I'm going to announce the sentences at the same time because your sentences are the same. I'm not going to draw any distinction, even though Mr. Van Rijn has previous convictions and you, Mr. Polis, and Ms. Smith does not have. On the human trafficking charge, you are sentenced to life imprisonment. On the kidnapping charge, you are sentenced to 10 years imprisonment. Because I've imposed life imprisonment, there is no need for me to rule on the concurrency of the sentences, because by operation of law, it will be served concurrently. Mr. Polis, do you understand that? Mr. Van Rijn, do you understand? Ms. Smith, do you understand? Thank you. You may be seated.
And that was what was decided. After months of trial and testimony, all three were found guilty, and their sentence was life in prison. But the verdict, while historic in its severity, could not answer the most painful question of all. Where is Jocelyn? From a legal standpoint, justice has been served on paper. The perpetrators have been punished, but with Jocelyn still missing, can justice ever be whole? Especially considering the fact that South African law recognizes trafficking as a heinous crime, with the Prevention and Combating of Trafficking in Persons Act offering stiff penalties. Yet without the recovery of the child, the process feels incomplete, a victory tainted by absence. The law says justice has been served, but if justice means closure, there is still a gaping hole. This case forces us to ask, what happens when the people meant to love and protect us turns into the ones who harm us? Now, over here in the Eastern Cape, in the town of Matatiele, another young girl, just 7 years old, spoke up about being raped at her private school in 2023. Her community rallied, the media paid attention, hashtags trended, her family did everything right. They listened to her, they reported the incident, and they fought for action. And yet, the National Prosecuting Authority declined to pursue the case. They claimed insufficient evidence. Now, here lies a legal contradiction. The Children's Act and Sexual Offences Act are supposed to offer the most comprehensive protections for minors in cases of sexual abuse. The child justice system was built to uphold the rights of young victims. So why was Gwigwit denied her day in court? The failure of the state to prosecute has left her mother on a relentless journey for justice, underscoring a grim truth. Our legal frameworks are only as effective as the people who enforce them. We are looking at two children, cases involving two children. And what we ask ourselves ultimately is whether or not there has been justice in any of these cases. With Jocelyn Smith, her mother, and co-conspirators were sentenced to life in prison. And ultimately, that is what you want. If somebody does something so horrible, so foul, you want them to be held accountable in the eyes of the law, and you want for the law to come down hard on them. And that's great, but what happens then when the child is not brought back? We still don't know where Jocelyn is. We don't know whether or not she's alive. And we don't know for sure where her remains are, should she not be. And what does that mean then for anybody who seeks closure, for Jocelyn's father, for community members that were also as part of the search group? We ask ourselves then whether or not justice constitutes somebody going to jail for whatever crimes they've committed, when ultimately they don't offer us any type of closure in the sense of understanding where the child is, what happened to her, some remorse, to go as far as to just show just any type of remorse towards the pain that child must have been enduring, that the pain the child probably still is enduring. That is ultimately the question. And within the Gqwetqwe case, we understand that no justice was ever attained from protests throughout the country, public outcry, social media, and media coverage all over. And yet still, the NPA is not pursuing the case themselves. And it makes the general public wary of leaning on a legal system that oftentimes proves itself to be inadequate. And I don't think it's the system so much as it is, like I said earlier, the people who enforce the legal rules, the legal frameworks. And if they don't seem to want to do their job, or they don't seem to want to push forward for some sort of change, what does that mean for a regular citizen? Someone who is dealing with abuse, who is dealing with all of the societal issues that we have and is needing to turn to law enforcement, what does that say to them? What do these kind of verdicts by the NPA do in helping them understand that there is a legal framework out there that is meant to protect them, serve them, and walk them through their lives, when we know more often than not that isn't the case? And we're seeing this with children, literal babies, six-year-olds, seven-year-olds, being hurt and killed at the hands of their caregivers, people that they're supposed to trust. I mean, with Gqwetqwe, it happened at school. With Jocelyn, it was her own parent. So what does that say? How safe are the children in our country? How safe are children in our communities? How do we ensure that we keep these children safe? How do we ensure that we build environments where these kind of things don't happen? Also, what are the warning signs for these types of issues? Because even within the Gqwetqwe case, they did every single thing right, and yet still nothing. So what does it mean? What kinds of cases get media attention? What kind of cases get legal intervention that is so efficient that it allows for some sort of justice to prevail? We're seeing that happen within two cases. And these are older women. Olorato Mongale has trended for quite some time, and mainly because of the fact that her friends raised quite a lot of awareness. But now we need to remember that behind every trending topic is a real person with dreams, fears, and a life that mattered. And Olorato was one of those people. She was a 30-year-old Wits University student and was known for her vibrant spirit and dedication to her studies. She had dreams just like any of us. But on a day like any other, she left her Johannesburg home, believing she was going on a date with somebody she had recently met. And hours later, her lifeless body was discovered in Lombardy East. The nation was shocked. Another young woman full of promise taken too soon. Investigations revealed a chilling pattern. The man she met, identified as Philanginkosi Makhanya, was part of a syndicate targeting women across the country. Alongside his accomplice, Bongani Mthimkhulu, they were linked to 22 cases of kidnapping and robbery. Women from various provinces, including Bloemfontein, Nelspruit, and Pretoria, identified them as the perpetrators. Makhanya was later killed in a shootout with police in KwaZulu-Natal, while Mthimkhulu remains at large. This type of urgency in policing is very rare. But even here, justice is partial. More suspects were involved, and unless they are brought to book, peace remains elusive. Legally, Olorato's case exemplifies a tension between punitive justice and restorative justice. We may punish a perpetrator, but what about closure, healing, and the deeper societal rot that allows such crimes to flourish? At Olorato's funeral in Bloemfontein, Minister in the Presidency for Women, Youth, and People with Disabilities, Sindisiwe Chikunga, urged the nation not to let Olorato become just another statistic. Her family, still grappling with the loss, expressed their anguish. They cannot find peace until all those responsible are brought to justice. I think it's very important for us to acknowledge the story with regards to Olorato. And we're also seeing parallels between Olorato's story and that of Uyinene. The parallels in the sense that their friends spoke out on social media when their friend went missing. When Uyinene went missing, her friends went all out, talking about the fact that she was missing. They took to social media, asking anyone who had seen her to please reach out. They just wanted to make sure she was okay. And the same thing happened with Olorato. And when ultimately we realized that these two young ladies had lost their lives at the hands of these men, it was heartbreaking to say the least. And it often feels like the reopening of the same wound, because you come to the realization that as a young woman, no matter where it is that you go, you're not safe. Be it the post office, be it school, going out on a date, whether or not you take your own car, if you go with somebody else's car, if you take an Uber, all of the safety measures that were taken by Olorato to make sure that, you know, her friends understood that she is safe, they saw where she was, her live location at all times, all of those things did not matter ultimately because of the fact that she lost her life. And she was found pretty quickly. And the alarm bells started ringing as soon as things started glitching. But unfortunately, by then, she'd already lost her life. And it's very worrying being a young woman in South Africa at the current moment, because we are not just in danger from intimate partner violence or gender-based violence. Any and everything could happen to you beyond what you would hope would be any type of safety restrictions you put in place. If someone wants to hurt you, they ultimately will. And that is a very scary and debilitating thing to come to grips with. Understanding the fact that no matter what you do, whatever safety precautions you follow won't change what will be inevitable. And we worry about our safety in a way that I think many people don't realize. In general, my hypervigilance is worrying to just the regular person. How do you know that that car passed three times now? You learn the number plate. You learn the number plate. You look at the model of the car. You check your surroundings completely, consistently. If you see the same person passing you time and again, you're able to actually recall that. Do you know how anxious of a person you have to be able to recall things like that, and to be able to just be in a social setting and having to recall those different things? Meeting just about anybody and looking for the first exit and making sure that you could make it to that exit before that person lays their hand on you. That's not normal. Like, normal women shouldn't have to be dealing with things like that. You shouldn't have to be worrying about whether or not you're carrying pepper spray or if you have like a weapon on hand. You shouldn't be worrying about those kind of things. It really shouldn't be the case, but it is. It is. It's such a scary thing, understanding the fact that we truly are in danger, and the rest of the world can see it. The rest of the country can see it. Police, law enforcement, everyone can see that this is a very big thing. It's a very big deal. But nothing is being done about it. And if we're keeping it above 50, nothing really is being done about it. Because in as much as it's great to sentence these people and arrest them as soon as it happens, what are we doing to prevent it? How are we combating this issue? How are we making sure that no other names are in the headlines? No other young women are hurt. No other young women are exploited or violated or even killed. How do we ensure that their safety is of utmost importance? How do we maintain that? We don't have these answers. And I think that's the scariest part about it, is understanding the fact that these are all these problems that we have, having the questions, not having any of the answers to them. And any of the answers that we might get are not even helpful in any regard. They don't inspire much hope. And we see that in the case of Uzimkita Ntshisele. In June 2023, Nelson Mandela University's George campus was devastated by a brutal act of femicide. Tourism management student Zimkita Ntshisele was stabbed to death in her residence room by her boyfriend, fellow student Luyanda Mahlanza. He stabbed her 16 times with 28 additional superficial wounds. He confessed. In May of 2025, the George Circuit High Court sentenced him to life in prison. The court emphasized the cruelty of the act and its impact on Zimkita's family and the broader university community. This ruling was clear, but it also came with a painful question. How did a crime this gruesome unfold on a university campus, a space that should have protected her? Despite the presence of institutional support systems and safety protocols, Zimkita fell through the cracks. The case challenges us to rethink how we protect women, especially in spaces meant to be safe. Now, those of you who attend Nelson Mandela University are very aware of the fact that we have a transformation office. We have counseling services from Mthonjeni. We have our campus security. We have a lot of programs aimed at combating crime, gender-based violence, intimate partner violence, any of that, grooming, you name it. It is mainly because we're trying to protect the students and we're also trying to teach them about the different forms of abuse that happen. And I remember there was a GBV week that was held by one of the law societies on campus. And it was viewed from the understanding that just anybody who had been a victim of gender-based violence from maybe even a young age came forward and they shared their testimonies. And it was hard. It was hard to hear. It was hard to listen to. But I'm sure living through it must have been even harder. And I think that was heartbreaking to have to sit through and understand the fact that this person came out on the other side of it, but this is so deeply ingrained in them that there is still some trauma. There are still some remnants of that trauma, and I think it will always be that way, unfortunately. These people, all of them, have been violated and hurt in the worst possible way. And what we hope would be closure in the form of accountability by the people who actually violated them. But in the case of Uzimkita, Uolorado, and Ujoshlin, being held accountable will not return these people. It won't bring them back to life. And I think Uolorado's mom said it better, that ultimately all she ever wanted was her child back. And she didn't get that child back. So whatever happens to the criminals, yes, they need to be brought to book, but that wound will never close because ultimately she lost a daughter. And the same can be said for the other parents in many of the cases we've mentioned. In the cases that we still have not mentioned, the number of names. There's a wall at VIDS, one of their campuses, actually, in Auckland Park. And this wall is a wall of women who have died mainly because of like abuse and exploitation and the like. That wall is full of names. Some names you've never heard before. Some names you've never seen before. They never made the headlines. They never made social media. But these are real people with lives and futures that they had ahead of them. They had dreams. They had life in them, and their lives were brutally taken away. And it is both baffling and also it paralyzes you with fear, understanding that no matter what, no matter how much you hope that there is justice out there, it won't bring these people back. And we shouldn't have to live like that. We shouldn't have to live in a world where we're consistently fearing for our lives. And I think we don't take it as seriously as I think we need to. Zimkita's story is so close to home in the sense that we're in the same institution as her. And she lost her life here. And I remember when we all heard that story, everyone was shook. Even when we were reporting on it, everyone was so scared and so emotional about it. But I'm realizing the more of these stories come out, the more numb we are becoming to it. And I want for us not to go to get that far. I do not want for us to get to a point where we're so used to hearing news of people being murdered, of people being raped, people being violated in various ways, not just people, women and children, young children, hearing about that should not just let us just be stagnant and not, this should be a catalyst for change. But how much change when the statistics are what they are? How many seminars, how many talks, how many men's imbizos or indabas or even conferences, how many of these are meant to be had between men and women, with groups of people talking about these issues and how rife they are? How many more conversations need to be had before we realize, okay, this is beyond conversation now? What does justice look like? In a case like this, where there is violence against people, how do we deal with that? Because ultimately, look at Philang Nkosi Makhanya. His parents hit him up and said, hey, you better run. The cops are coming to find you. Homie opened fire, they opened fire back and he lost his life. But nothing, it did nothing for the family. Him dying did nothing for the family's closure. But even then, had they arrested him, brought him to book, held him accountable, sentenced him to life, would there still have been justice? What does justice look like for this? What kind of world do we live in where even if you're arrested or if you're killed in the line of, okay, I don't want to say the line of fire because technically, why are you even firing shots? But what happens? What is the world coming to if, honestly, we can't even rely on those types of consequences and repercussions to actually bring us closure? If we can't rely on these things, then what happens now? Where's our trust? Where do we feel safe? How do we feel safe? And the only answer to that is if these killings could just stop. We know death way too much. We are too familiar with death. We are too familiar with the notion of dust to dust. We know death way, way too much. We're too acquainted with it. And women, for the most part, are realizing just how close we are to death. That death, ultimately, could be our blanket this winter. And how sad is that? To live with that kind of reality. To understand that you may have made it into this year, but you may not make it out. And it may be because of the fact that somebody else feels entitled to your body, to the breath inside of you. Jocelyn, Kwekwe, Olorato, Zimkita. Each story is a thread in the fabric of a nation at war with itself. South Africa's constitution is clear. Everyone has the right to dignity, to life, to freedom from violent acts. And yet, for many women and children, these rights only exist in theory. So what does it mean to be a woman in South Africa? It means walking with keys clenched between your fingers. It means not trusting public spaces. It means demanding justice in a system that doesn't always answer. And as students, as future lawyers, judges, and journalists, we have a duty. The law is a tool, but it must be sharpened by compassion, by reform, and by the voices of those who refuse to be silenced. And unfortunately, loud as we may be, sometimes the voices inside our throats are choked out by men who feel that they are entitled to them. Let this episode teach you that there are many names out there, that we are in grave danger, and we run the risk of ultimately not even having a generational message or mission, because there will be no generation. This has been The Law Show on Madiba's Radio, where we connect, inform, and absolutely engage. My name is Katlego Mofokeng. Until next week, peace out.
Opening up the waves for you to be heard.